to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear.
The first time I heard KBFK, it was in the wee hours, maybe 2 a.m., Roy of Hollywood was on, right? And he was playing Alan Watts. And it was so surreal. I was like, what is this? What is this? What kind of radio is this? You know? I mean, it just blew my mind. And I got hooked right away.
KPFK.
This is Gary Oldman. You're listening to radio powered by the people. KPFK 90.7 FM.
If you would like to support your favorite radio station, KPFK, please consider donating your vehicle to us, whether it's operational or not, because your donation helps KPFK as well as present you with an opportunity to write it off of your taxes. And if you would like to donate and get more information, please give us a call at 877-KPFK-AUTO. Once again, that's 877-KPFK-AUTO. Peace.
Hi, this is Sally Kirkland, and you're listening to KPFK, radio powered by the people, fiercely independent, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm director-producer Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Weissman. Susie is traveling for the holidays and will be back on January 12th. Over the last couple of weeks, we have been sharing with you many of the insightful and critical conversations from the recent conference held in honor of Boris Kagarlitsky, currently a prisoner in Russia for speaking out against Putin's war in Ukraine, and also a great thinker of the international left and author of The Long Retreat, a sobering analysis of the global left that was discussed on last week's show. Her speakers today, Trevor Ngwame, a South African scholar activist at the University of Johannesburg, and Nancy Fraser, professor of philosophy and politics at the New School for Social Research, bring to the table some difficult truths and critical questions for the global left. Trevor Ngwame outlines the brutal history of South Africa's turn to neoliberalism and its consequences, widespread suffering and deepening despair among ordinary people, as well as a political crisis within the ANC, and asks what will it take to revitalize the vibrant, militant, and international working class movements that once overthrew apartheid and can still be a powerful force for social change in the world today. Nancy Fraser then reflects on Kagarlitsky's sobering analysis of the chaotic political reality we are in today and raises three central strategic questions for the left and mass politics. How can we engage with actually existing social forces and convince them to join with us in a struggle towards positive social change? How do we navigate the geopolitics of war and migration in mass movement organizing? And what would a transformative working class movement even look like in the 21st century? After their presentations, Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats in America, will join me in studio to discuss the critical insights and questions brought up by these two speakers, and we consider what this might mean for American politics at this particular moment in history, as we face a new year filled with radical uncertainty, political confusion, and deepening crisis. All this when our program returns in just a moment.
I will be as sure as I can. It's wonderful to be with all you dear comrades. Boris, when he visited, as Fiona mentioned, here in Johannesburg, was at a time of an academic boycott being relaxed. And so I want to reflect on that briefly. But I also want to thank, John Devenish has mentioned something we call BRICS from below, or People's BRICS. And a huge salute to Anna Oshkina, who was with us for one of those, the first one, 2013, Ilya Matveev, who was with us here in Johannesburg 2018, the late Alexander Brizgalin, and of course Boris. And you can see on a YouTube channel Boris's input to the BRICS from below. And from the 22nd to 24th in Kazan, we'll see Vladimir Putin hosting the BRICS. Our efforts to use the BRICS to try to leverage, certainly from, even though back in 2011 we did have an academic boycott against Ben-Gurion University and broke a water research contract. It just shows that even in a liberated place like South Africa, one that took Israel to the International Court of Justice for genocide, but that we learned this week is the number one exporter of coal to Israel, we do face the dialectic. Boris would be amused and be encouraging for us to keep struggling. But actually, I turn it over to Comrade Trevor Ngwani, who knows much more how to struggle at this university. I'm much more recent here than he is. So he'll be the expert that takes forward the struggles for political liberation and academic freedom. Thanks, comrades.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, Boris Kakalinski is a hero. He stood up to Putin and his totalitarian regime. He refused to leave Russia, choosing to fight in the belly of the beast. He did this in solidarity with all the millions of workers who are never given the option of walking away to settle abroad. There are those who just cannot walk away, and those who try to walk away but are followed by the assassin's bullet or the killer's poison. Today we're meeting in honor of Comrade Boris Kakalinski. He's a comrade with a long and proud track record of fighting behind the red flag for the socialist alternative. He has stood up in opposition of the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. He joined the anti-war movement in Russia. And as Comrade Adam said earlier, Boris took a Leninist position, defeatism. Russia should be defeated in its war with the Ukraine. Let Roman Tiber melt and the wide arc of the ranged empire fall. Here is my space in a prison cell in Zelenograd. I want to say, to state categorically, my opposition to the Zionist illegal occupation of Palestine and the massacre and the hardships the Zionist government is visiting upon Palestinians, including men, women, and children. Also, I want to denounce in the strongest terms the invasion of the Ukraine by Putin's armies. He's dropping off bombs on residential and industrial areas where the working class lives and works. The resultant death, injury, and displacement of thousands and millions of people. Socialism or barbarism? We are living in difficult times. Rosa Luxemburg said the sharpening of the class struggle in the context of a rolling capitalist crisis would soon put a stark choice before humanity, socialism or barbarism. I think today that moment has come. Barbarism is not an abstraction. It is not a speculation. We see it right there in front of our eyes. The genocide in Palestine and the murderous invasion of the Ukraine. Today, it is normal that a decision made by a government somewhere in the world, or indeed even made by a single techno-capitalist in New York, say the South African-born and Trump groupie Elon Musk, can lead to the suffering and even death of thousands of people in many parts of the world. Capitalist violence is the order of the day. It comes in many forms. It can be a bullet or a bomb. It can be an economic policy, austerity, structural violence. Let the children die. Killing thousands of people has become a news item you think about before your train of thought is rudely disrupted by a commercial. The British singer David Rovix sang these lines in a song he called As the Bombs Rain Down. See the homes, apartment blocks. See the mosques reduced to rocks. Feel the awe and feel the shock as the bombs rain down. This is happening in Palestine and in Russia and undoubtedly in other parts of the world. Normalizing poverty, unemployment, and inequality. In South Africa, after 30 years of democracy, poverty, unemployment, and inequality has become normalized. In the name of national liberation, the party of Nelson Mandela, the African National Congress, supervised the country into normalizing a neoliberal capitalist hell. South Africa is regularly labeled the most unequal society in the world. In 2023, the Gini coefficient was 63, the highest in the world. Another notorious acronym in South Africa, which is used daily, is GBV, gender-based violence. South Africa has one of the highest rape rates in the world, with 132 incidents per 100,000 people. A woman is raped in South Africa every 12 minutes. One in four men admit to committing a rape. Life is a nightmare for women. South Africa has one of the highest rates of child growth stunting in the world, with 27% of children under 5 years of age affected. Stunting is a form of chronic malnutrition which impacts cognitive development and has severe implications for learning, earning, and the general well-being of a person. I can say from my own observation of life in Soweto, the biggest township in South Africa, that there's an alcoholic and substance abuse epidemic in South Africa. The working class is facing a severe socio-economic crisis. Is there a political solution? Political setbacks, one step forward, two steps backward. No one was surprised when in the last general elections, the ANC lost its parliamentary majority. Its mismanagement of the country as it ruthlessly implemented pro-capitalist, anti-working class policies, including its policy of creating a black bourgeoisie, has ensured that the rich has gotten richer and the poor poorer. It also made the working class voters turn against it. The ANC got 40% of the vote, and instead of finding a partner to form a coalition government, it opted for a government of national unity. This was a ploy to work together with right-wing and center-right political parties. The aim is to use the politics of compromise and consensus as a fig leaf to allow the ANC to continue implementing the very same pro-capitalist policies that made it lose its majority. In truth, the main concern of the ANC top leadership is to keep in the running and to be part of the racket, as Frantz Fanon described the post-liberation national bourgeoisie in Africa. They know they became a nouveau bourgeoisie at the expense of the working class And they have no intention of stopping doing so. Attack on the right to strike. The working class movement was never defeated in South Africa. Instead, the ANC used the moment of liberation to demobilize, demoralize, and contain organized labor and the militant black working class movements that successfully challenged the apartheid regime, leading to its defeat. The ANC, South African Communist Party, and Congress of South African Trade Unions Alliance became a tool to ensure that working class leaders committed class suicide. Many of them, like the current president of the ANC and of the Cyril Ramaphosa, organized workers in the mines during the anti-apartheid struggle and became mine owners in the so-called New South Africa. They crossed the class line. Of course, many ANC leaders were members of a radicalized black petty bourgeoisie. Racial capitalism pushed them to join the National Liberation Movement, including dabbling in working class politics. They justified their bourgeois aspirations and greed for riches on the grounds of the racial and class frustrations engendered by racial capitalism. The right to strike was under attack from year one in 1994, the year of liberation. The strike movement was the battering ram that forced capital to seek a solution to the political and economic crisis beyond apartheid. Starting in the 1973 Durban strikes, workers engaged in strikes without following any procedure because there was no procedure. Apartheid did not allow black workers to form unions, let alone go on strike. Over time, the strikes became very militant, including sit-down strikes that involved occupation of factories and mines, community support for strikes, consumer boycotts of bosses, etc. The solution, from the point of view of the capitalist class, called now and appropriate at that time white monopoly capital, was the institutionalization of industrial conflict, including implementing a Labor Relations Act, which required long drawn out and complicated procedures before workers could go on strike, including cooling off periods and compulsory mediation and arbitration. When Ramaphosa took over as president of the country in 2018, he made it his priority to further attack the right to strike, introducing various regulations to achieve this end. Managerialism, underpinned by an aggressive assertion of the managerial prerogative, has created a dictatorial regime in South African workplaces, in the public and private sectors. The culmination of this was the Marikana massacre in August 2012, when 34 miners on strike were shot dead by the state police. The dynamics of that strike included the class collaboration of trade union leaders with the bosses. In the context of an unemployment rate of 40%, deregulation and flexibilization of labor, political disorientation, and other challenges facing workers, the position of employed workers has been severely undermined and their power weakened. Going forward, it is important to realize the need to go back to the basics of working class politics. Marx said the working class is the revolutionary class because of its structural location in the capitalist system, in the mode of production. Their power derives from their role as producers, most importantly, as collective producers. Despite the atomization and decomposition dynamics introduced by capital, the class in itself exists and it can become a class for itself. The absence of a fighting working class movement is the denominator and chief characteristic of the reversals faced by the class and by humanity today. Our job is to revitalize this movement. We must not sidestep this task. We must not rationalize it away. We must not play it down. The struggle for socialism is a struggle to revive and revitalize the working class movement and its allies, to remove all obstacles that stop workers becoming what they can be. An aspect of this struggle is to recognize and denounce the capitalist restoration taking place in Russia and China. The battle to liberate Comrade Boris Kagalinsky, as we are doing today in this wonderful webinar, is part of that struggle. Thank you very much.
Nancy Fraser is what the French call une sommité, a leading light who has made influential contributions to the fields of philosophy, feminist theory, and critical theory. She teaches at New York's New School for Social Research, where she is the Henry and Louise A. Loeb Professor of Philosophy and Politics. She's also a member of the editorial committee of the New Left Review. Nancy is the recipient of numerous awards and honors. She is a Chevalier of the French Legion of Honor, France's highest decoration. She's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In 2018, she was awarded the Nassim Habif World Prize. And in 2022, she received the Nonino Master of Our Time Prize, among many other distinctions. A prolific scholar, she has written extensively on justice and is renowned for her discussions of the relationship between recognition and redistribution in struggles for social justice, as well as for her contributions to feminist and Marxist theory. She has written or co-authored several books in recent years, including The Old is Dying, Feminism for the 99%, and Capitalism, A Conversation in Critical Theory. Her latest book, published by Verso in 2022, is Cannibal Capitalism: How Our System is Devouring Democracy, Care, and the Planet, and What We Can Do About It. And we have the pleasure and privilege of hearing her speak today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all the organizers of this event. It's wonderful and very moving to hear words from Boris on this occasion and to feel a connection established here across many time zones and continents and oceans and indeed empires. We've come together across all those distances in a display of international left solidarity in action. And that is a really wonderful and moving thing. In fact, as has already been said, there are actually far too few events like these. Boris Kagalinsky is far from the only left-wing Russian anti-war activist who has suffered repression. And there are, we might say, Borises everywhere in Palestine and in Israel, in Iran and in China, in India and Brazil, in Germany, France, and in the United States. Most of these repressed leftists are less well known to the international left intelligentsia than Boris is, but they are equally in need of our support. And this event, I hope, can serve as a model. In a moment of acute global crisis and repression, we should be multiplying events like these again and again. But of course, And defending endangered comrades is the bare minimum when it comes to practicing international left solidarity. We should also take them seriously. We should honor their thinking and their practice. And as Kagarlitsky himself would be the first to remind us, and indeed has reminded us, we should think with them and about them strategically. If they are truly our comrades, we must think about how to connect their struggles with ours, their predicaments with ours, and with the struggles and predicaments of others. In other words, we need to pursue not simply resistance, but emancipatory social change. That's what Boris himself has asked us to do. Now, we will be discussing his recent book, The Long Retreat, where this problem is front and center, this problem of going beyond resistance to coalitions of change. I don't want to steal the thunder of our distinguished panelists who will be talking about the book, but I want to note that it provides both a brilliant analysis of the current conjuncture and an impassioned plea for strategic thinking. Kagarlitsky diagnoses an acute crisis of neoliberal capitalism, what Adam Tooze has called a polycrisis, a crisis that is at once economic, ecological, social reproductive, political, and of course, now we have to add geopolitical. It's a crisis that our global ruling classes cannot resolve. They cannot decarbonize the global economy in time to halt planetary conflagration. They cannot provide decent livelihoods and meaningful work to billions of people across the globe. They can neither prevent nor successfully manage global pandemics. They cannot protect us from the violence of armies, police, banks, landlords, and unhinged, infuriated mobs. They cannot defeat rising authoritarian movements, even when the latter appear to threaten them. They cannot stop war. In fact, far from stopping this nexus of horribles, the system they embody actually produces all these things. For Boris, accordingly, and I fully agree, our polycrisis admits of no enlightened capitalist solution, if that phrase is not a contradiction in terms. The crisis is systemic and objective. But not only. Our crisis is also, let's say, subjective and hegemonic. Masses of people now intuit that the predicaments they experience cannot be resolved by patchwork reform. Many of them want some kind of radical change. And so masses of people throughout the globe are defecting from politics as usual. They are ditching established parties and worldviews. They are thinking outside the box. They are looking for radical alternatives. But we have to ask, what do they find when they look for radical alternatives? According to Kagarlitsky, they find no credible socialist alternative, no confident bloc of left-wing social forces that conveys a programmatically serious and strategically sound commitment to deep structural change. On the contrary, the forces that might have coalesced in this sort of counter-hegemony were atrophied and disoriented over the course of a decades-long retreat of the left. That's Boris's thesis. What usurps their place today, I would suggest, and I think I'm in agreement with him, are two mutually antagonistic formations. First, a smattering, maybe it's more than a smattering, a group of moralizing, identity-siloed groups that have lost whatever transformative emancipatory drive they once possessed. You can call that, if you want to be nasty, wokeism. I don't want to be that nasty. And second, a panoply of authoritarian populist counter-movements, which, and this is Boris's phrase, which mix legitimate economic grievances with regressive ethnocultural hatreds. These two forces, I call them progressive neoliberalism and reactionary populism, are today locked in a series of sham battles, which get nowhere near to the heart of things. The result is a morass of morbid symptoms that Antonio Gramsci would easily recognize. Now, Kagarlitsky's diagnosis, which I think is close, if not in all points, but in its general shape with the one I've just outlined, his diagnosis seems right to me. But what is to be done? Is there a possible path today that can rebuild the left in the near future? And of course, we have to add not just any left, but one that gives up sectarianism and utopianism in favor of realism, strategy, and imagination. So is there a path to rebuilding this kind of, let's say, mature left, a left that is actually adequate to the seriousness and breadth and depth of our crisis? Or must we content ourselves with a well-managed retreat that will allow us to live to fight another day? And of course, if you take that second line, then you have to ask yourself, is there going to be another day before the planetary conflagration? These are questions that I long to discuss with Boris Kagarlitsky. I've never met him, but I have carried on a dialogue with him about these questions inside my head. Truth be told, I'm a bit more optimistic than he is. And I want to explain why in terms of three specific questions that are preoccupying me. The first I just mentioned, retreat or counter-hegemony, you can just to put it in a nutshell. The second is the question of class, of the global or working class, how we understand it. And the third is geopolitics. These are all questions that are deep, troubling, and difficult, and that I'm not confident that I know exactly what I think about them. But the question of retreat versus counter-hegemony, I think the key here is, in thinking strategically, to start with the actually existing social forces to determine which, if any, among them are potentially emancipatory, potentially, maybe not right now, emancipatory, potentially emancipatory, and which are worth wooing, which, in other words, could, in theory, be split off from their current allies and turn to the left. Who among the wokists, that is the rank and file feminists and anti-racists, anti-colonials, can be persuaded to desert their corporate protectors and to adopt a class perspective that better fits the real social positions that they occupy? Who among the rank and file reactionary populace can be induced to desert the adored strongman who are fated to betray them and who could instead make common cause with other working class segments they now despise? That's the kind of question I'm thinking about strategically. Class is key to this question, obviously, and so that is the second issue I want to mention. Boris rightly stresses that today's global working class is not the industrial working class of the 19th century. He rightly concludes that a socialism for the 21st century must differ accordingly from all earlier models. Class, he assumes, and I fully agree, remains the crucial societal differentiation. And in the end, it's got to be the crucial rallying point for a left. But this cannot be your grandfather's idea of class. The question is, how can we understand the global working class today? Is there a way to think about that class that is neither outdated industrialism nor some pluralistic mélange of differences, something that would shade into the Hartnagri multitude idea? Neither of those is adequate. I think that I fully agree with Kagarlitsky. Now, I'll just mention very quickly without going into detail that I believe that there is a way to think about class that falls into neither of those two categories. And it's because it's a structural way of thinking about class. I think that capitalism, capital accumulation, depends now and always has on at least three distinct but mutually imbricated forms of labor. Exploited labor, that is the doubly free workers in factories, the expropriated labor, that is unfree or semi-free people, colonials, natives, slaves, peons, and the forms they assume today, right? Trafficked sex workers, imprisoned workers, and so on and so forth. Workers who don't get to sell their own labor power and don't enjoy actionable rights or state protections. And finally, a group that I'm going to call domesticated workers, those who specialize in social reproduction, especially the reproduction of labor power. My idea is that surplus value cannot be extracted from exploited workers in the absence of cheap inputs supplied by expropriated workers and of cheap labor supplied by domesticated workers. You can already see that this suggests a global working class divided not only by country and region and empire, but also by gender and by ethno-racial divisions. This links up, I hope you can see, with my first question about who to woo and how to woo them. What if we could convince working class racialized people that they have a role in a system that is completely imbricated and inextricably so from the exploited workers who have always occupied center stage in socialist movements to the present? What if we could convince working class feminists that they really are workers and that their issues can be well illuminated through the lens of labor and of class? Third and last point, geopolitics. Here we have to talk, I think, about two things: war and migration. If we're talking about war and imperialism and inter-imperialist rivalry and a vacuum of geopolitical hegemony with the relative rise of China, relative decline of the US, and so on, if that's one axis of the problem, it might make sense to think that the alternatives have to do with a left that is nationalist versus a left that is internationalist. And that is right. However, if we put migration at the center, things become a little more complicated. And this has everything to do with working class reactionary populism, which centers largely on opposition to migration. There, the issue is nationalism versus transnationalism, not internationalism. How we put both of these things together, I don't know. But it seems to me it's extremely important. The fact of the matter is we do not have and have not had for a very long time any real sense of what a left foreign policy would be today. This is the weakest part of the left, in my opinion. Here and there, you find people who have some interesting ideas about reorganizing production or even reproduction. But foreign policy is somehow an uncharted space. The key thing, and this is my very last point, to me, is how to keep two no's in your head at once and how to turn them into some kind of a yes. Example, no to Putin, no to NATO. Don't say one without the other. What's the yes that points to? I can't say. Similarly, no to Gazan genocide, no to anti-Semitism. How to put both together and end up with something else. And this inability to deal with that last one is wreaking havoc among populations who are distraught over the Middle East everywhere. No to Putin, no to NATO. I really want to hear what the Russian colleagues say to that. As someone, as an American who is a firm anti-American, I can't put all the blame on Putin. But we might disagree about this. I really want to have more discussion of it. In any case, these are three questions I want to discuss with Boris and with you. And what a shame that he's not here, but how great that you are here. Thank you.
Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm producer-director Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Weissman. And I'm joined now in studio by Alan Minsky, who is the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, former program director at KPFK, and producer of this show. Welcome.
Yeah, great to be here. And it's great to actually be here on the occasion where you're playing some of the talks from the Boris Kagarlitsky conference, which unfortunately I could not attend because my schedule in October was so consumed around the American elections. But I did, of course, sign on to everything in support and in solidarity with Boris. And I think I was a bit of a sort of outstanding signatory in terms of, I think I was the only person signing on who had a Democratic Party association in the way I signed the letter. And certainly, I think it is a cause that every progressive, and really, we got to make sure that masses of people in the United States are aware of what Boris is going through and stand in solidarity with him. And of course, full respect for his thinking, his theories, his ideas about contemporary politics and the left. And it was a marvelous conference.
Absolutely. So we've just heard two talks, one from Trevor Ngwame from South Africa, who, was talking really about this, very depressing situation that, neoliberalism has kind of gotten us all into in the world today, as well as Nancy Fraser, who kind of took Boris's analysis of where the left is. And I think we're all, as we're heading into 2025, whatever the heck that's going to bring for us politically, trying to consider, what is to be done in this moment in time. And, you as a political leader in the movement within a very difficult party, also the Democratic Party, currently dominated by a neoliberal faction, some of these questions are absolutely relevant and very important in the work that you're doing. So yeah, I'd love to hear some of your insights.
Well, obviously, I'm a little bit of an outlier from where the Democratic Party has been, but hopefully not where it's going, if there's anything that comes to fruition from the work I'm trying to do and we're trying to do at PDA. But I do want to speak first to the previous speaker, Nancy Fraser. Of course, I'm familiar with her work, and I think she's an exceptional contemporary social critic in terms of really laying out with great clarity the breadth of the problems that we face as a human species on this planet right now, and the manner in which all the promise that become apparent through the rise of technological, industrial, and scientific development over the past few centuries, and all of it adding up to a place where it seems to have just led us all very, very astray. And the forces that have led us down that path are very much still in power. Yet we are at a moment, and this is my sort of key jumping off point, to try to propose something possibly positive in the realm of even American electoral politics, which is that there's a widespread awareness of the failings, not only in terms of obviously something like the climate and the climate emergency, but of all the social crises in the United States and the general sense of the population that the society has gone in the wrong direction. There's a widespread sense that something significant has to change. And this, of course, has informed the ascent of Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. But here's the thing. I think we all can pretty much probably agree, all our listeners out there and certainly the previous two speakers, that nothing that the MAGA movement and Trump are going to present right now are going to provide adequate solutions to the issues that have led to their ascendancy politically. That's going to leave a considerable political void. And if we still do have a representative constitutional democracy in the United States of America, with something close to at least the kind of playing field which isn't level but was roughly about the same space of levelness as it was in the last election, is it possible that given the neoliberal center has completely failed, the Trumpian right wing will have completely failed, that it's possible for a progressive, even a radical left, to ascend within the electoral realm? And in thinking about this and in trying to organize progressive Democrats of America as a force within electoral politics to respond to these crises and to provide the population with an option to support and participate in that can truly and adequately, at least if we can't fully address them because we're not directly challenging the fact of capitalism at the heart of the problem, can we take us into a space where, again, even those possibilities can go further past that in terms of addressing capitalism as the sort of root organizing principle of our society, but to at least go back to the kind of Rooseveltian social democratic or soft socialist policies that at least we feel are necessary to address the crises we face and to provide the population of the United States with a more readily approved of social order in which working people can, again, have prosperous lives, they can have much greater control over their lives, and they can contribute to a society which in the United States, with all of its diversity, still at this hour, at this late hour, has tremendous promise.
Thank you for that. It was one thing that Nancy Fraser brought up coming out of Kagarlitsky's analysis that, you know, I really think is very interesting is where is the left going? Is it a retreat or a counter hegemony, as she puts it? And she outlines basically three general tendencies that are prevalent in our political and cultural landscape today. One, of course, is the reactionary populism embodied by Trump and the MAGA movement. And of course, there's a neoliberal center, which has pretty much collapsed because of its failure to deliver anything to the working class, as Trevor has illustrated with the example of South Africa, but also everywhere in the world. And then she does call out what, of course, she didn't want to call wokeism because there is, of course, the bigoted reactions from the right wing, but she also interestingly posits the identitarian trend, shall we say, as unhelpful to a working class politics. As she put it, is a pluralistic multitude of differences really adequate for a class politics and socialism for the 21st century? And of course, I get it. As a woman of color growing up in the 80s and 90s where there were no safe spaces, I recognize the vital importance of having a safe space around you and to insist on those things. But at the same time, if we don't win over at least a plurality or a critical mass of the general populace towards a progressive and radical politics that are transformative, none of us will be safe. And it all comes back to Nancy's questions about, do we retreat to our safe spaces? Do we insist on a counter-hegemony everyone has to sign on to? And how does that really figure into a class politics where the struggle really is over the material things of life? Healthcare, living wage, how do we make people's lives better? So, Progressive Democrats of America, you struggle for these things, as well as respect and equality for difference, for historically marginalized people. So, yeah, I'm interested in your thoughts around these strategic questions.
Well, I mean, so much there to unpack. But first of all, I want to point people to an article that was in the Jacobin Magazine website. Here's How Economic Populism Can Win by Jared Abbin, Dustin Guastella, and Sean Mason. And I believe that the name of the organization they work through is the Center for Working Class Politics. And it's an article that says, to win competitive districts, left-wing candidates must challenge both economic oligarchy and cultural elitism. And when people are talking about the end of the woke era, and how the general public has, you know, and obviously there's been a wholesale right-wing media frontal attack on what they saw as a vulnerable point on the left and DEI and wokeness. And, you know, people really, when they think about DEI, don't think about it generally in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion as a concept. Think of it more about the way that the right was able to turn on it because of all this way that people in their jobs had to go to trainings that they felt were very divisive within their work spaces. And it was the way corporate America engaged those subjects, I think, was a huge turnoff. But then it was readily turned against the left politically. But, you know, think about the term cultural elitism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're looking at the American working class for years upon years, if you turned on late night television, you saw, you know, middle class and working class Americans, predominantly the butt of the jokes would have been white working class Americans, really being made fun of. And I think, you know, I don't think anybody in those communities would have had a hard time sensing that the writers of those jokes were on the coast. They were probably from elite colleges who were writing them. And the general sense of cultural resentment was there. It was real. It was being foisted upon those communities. The communities felt disempowered without any voice. And the Democratic Party seem to reflect entirely that kind of cultural elitism among its leaders and the people who are guiding its policies, much more so than the Republican Party. And that's a big part of the reason why the Republican Party, almost a single party across the huge expanse of the geography of the United States of America and small town and rural America, is the sense of just cultural disrespect that people felt across the country from who they viewed as cultural elites. So that has to drop. Now, one of the reasons I really was excited to sort of follow Nancy's talk was this discussions and mentions of Gramsci. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we are trying to do with PDA and trying to think about is, can the left wing of the really existing Democratic Party, and by the way, there's a leadership battle over the direction of the Democratic Party between the progressive wing and the centrists. Major moment's going to be the selection of the next head of the DNC, which will happen on February 1st of this upcoming year. And the idea that I think we have to consider on the progressive left is, can you really sort of have a party within a party, and how much can that party be structured along the lines of what Gramsci outlines in The Modern Prince? Because I think there's a real appetite for that. And hear me out here. I know that might sound really like a far reach, but think about this, folks. Look, as I mentioned earlier, the Trumpian populist government is going to fail to deliver the transformations that the working class seeks. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, the other great dissatisfaction that the public has with American politicians is their unresponsiveness, that they are absolutely detached from what average people and working class people are asking of them. Now, the Democratic Party and, of course, the Republican Party has actually been better about this than the Democratic Party in recent iterations, does not welcome people in from the base into the party. Can we create a space which welcomes people into the party? And we were trying to do that at PDA. And both as an organization, an inside-outside organization, but also through the channel of the progressive caucuses of the state Democratic parties across all of the 50 states plus the six regions in D.C., so 57 areas, 57 Democratic parties, and invite people into the party through those progressive caucuses and to create a space where you can actually have an inclusive, participatory Democratic Party where people from localities and regions around the country have their voices heard and demand of the politicians that they're responsive to their needs and their voices. And of course, that space cannot be defined by cultural elitism. It has to be a space of solidarity and of inclusion. And as they noted in this nice article, again, here's how economic populism can win. You know, football, yes, WWE, okay, it's going to have as much respect, seriously, yeah. It's going to have as, people are going to have to, if they're from the elite schools, if they think they're going to go in there and they're going to demand that people have read all the theoretical literature they've read, no, They're going to be concerned about, you know, how it is that we create a prosperous middle class society. And yeah, probably it's not going to go at it with like a direct critique of capitalism either. That'll come up here and there. People are not that happy with capitalism, the general population. In fact, there's a huge appetite for progressive left economics. That's also shown in the article that I'm citing here. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to build those structures inside the party. And again, the model is, again, that I love the idea once I attached onto it of what Gramsci writes in The Modern Prince. He's talking about a communist party there. I'm talking about a left wing of a really existing democratic party. And I grew up partly in Italy. And I remember going to the Unità festivals. And you would see the countercultural hegemony that was still being, you know, worked to be developed in Italy in the 1970s. And of course, the Communist Party of Italy was at its electoral peak in the 1970s. So, you know, can that kind of energy be brought into the Democratic Party? And I know that might sound insane to people, but hear me out, folks. First of all, if you are somebody who's listening to this and you're maybe a DSA member or you're drawn to, say, not want to vote for the Democratic Party but vote for the Green Party, have no illusions. The platform of the left wing of the Democratic Party, of the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, is virtually identical to the platforms of DSA and the Green Party. First of all, that I think people need to understand if they're writing this idea off. And secondly, the third partyism is never going to work in our system. It has never worked before. The population is locked into accepting the two-party system. And so that's really the terrain of struggle where I think we have to move into with the expectation of winning control of the party and then transforming society accordingly.
I'm so glad you brought up Gramsci, because I have this quote that I was just reading as we were listening to Nancy Fraser that really kind of speaks to what you've been talking about and what we have been talking about here. What kind of class politics can and should we have in the 21st century? And for Gramsci, a lot of his theory around the modern prince hinges on a method, really, that he calls the philosophy of praxis, that speaks to, again, doing things, really, to make people's lives better, doing things and demonstrating the force and validity of the politics that you're putting forward through action and not just talk. I mean, I do feel like that in the 21st century, we are inundated with so much information that just talking isn't going to convince people. And the other thing he insists on is what he calls proletarian hegemony, which really means speaking the truth about people's lives. So, and here's the quote. The philosophy of praxis does not aim at the peaceful resolution of existing contradictions in history and society, but is rather the very theory of these contradictions. It is not the instrument of government, of dominant groups, to gain the consent of and exercise hegemony over the subaltern classes. If you're really a political force that embraces the philosophy of praxis, then that force becomes the expression of the subaltern classes who want to educate themselves in the art of government, who have an interest in knowing all truths, even the unpleasant ones, and in avoiding the impossible deceptions of the upper class and, even more, their own. Gramsci argues that a politics of truth is necessary. He states on many occasions that the precondition for doing mass politics in the working class is to speak the truth.
I love it. And look, and I'd say this too. I read Nancy Fraser's, I believe, most recent book, Cannibal Capitalism, and it sort of was laid out in a few sections. And the fundamental political asks that book is making of humanity and of the left, I think, are actually quite popular with the American public. Mm-hmm. Again, if they are shared with people, if people are able to then contribute their ideas and their reflections on their experience and how they can be improved by the political transformations necessary to adequately address the core concerns of that book, I just think we're in a very, very dynamic time in American history. I think that the neoliberal order has broken, at least in the hearts and minds of people across the country, if not into the hearts and minds of the ruling class yet. And people are looking for an alternative because they see the way the society has gone for the last 45 years is a dead-end road.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to leave it there, but that's a wonderfully hopeful thing to to leave our listeners on. So thank you so much for joining us today on Beneath the Surface.
So thank you so much. It's great to be here.
That's our show for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Trevor Nwome, Nancy Fraser, and Alan Minsky. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brenner, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, Gary Baca in Master Control, and of course, our host, Susie Weissman. You can hear this and other archive shows by going to kpfk.org and clicking on Archives, scroll down to Beneath the Surface. More information on our guests can be found on our Facebook page, Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. You've been listening to Beneath